tell me what they know as opposed to trying to draw out something
Okay,
that I don't.
okay.
But, well, for starters, why don't you tell me a little bit about Prophetstown Revisited and what's going on with that and why it's significant, and then we can go from there.
Okay. Well, the Prophetstown Revisited conference is it was started by Chris Bross in the English department, but the idea is that people who are participating in early American studies kind of areas, there's a lot of people that are interested in the oral history of that Tecumseh produced and the general history around that particular period. And so I think it was the idea that was because the founding of Prophetstown is 2008, this seemed like a good opportunity for the Society of Early Americanists to host a conference. Every other year they do a conference that focuses on something specific, and they take it to a location, and so it seemed like a good opportunity, you know, to bring it here for the founding of the Prophetstown community.
That is very interesting because history is so tied to specific locations in a lot of different ways.
Right, it's all about the place. That's my theory.
So why don't we talk about Prophetstown and
Okay.
how Prophetstown was important to the Indians, what significance it had for Tecumseh and his followers?
Well, today, I think I'd start with today, and
Okay,
I'd
that would be
say,
great.
yeah, I'd say that the very, there is no Native American opinion on anything because there's over 600 nations, so it's diverse people with diverse histories. But for a lot of Native Americans who are here in Indiana, who live in the region, people in Oklahoma, even Canada, there are many people that see the site itself as a sacred site because it was a really significant event in history. And I think its significance historically is mostly that it was a place where pan-Indian resistance came together to stop, you know, colonial settlement any further and expansion, to draw a line in the sand. And it was an unsuccessful, you know, action to do that. And pretty much after that is when most of the removals, the federal Indian policy uses forced removal to get most Indian nations, organized nations, across the Mississippi into Oklahoma Territory and out west. So the people that stayed behind then between like 1800 and 1900 are just dispossessed of their lands systematically. So now you have Native American communities east of the Mississippi, but most of the time, as in Indiana, there's no recognized lands that they have, you know, holdings. So it's significant for that. It came to be because Tenskwatawa, a Shawnee, had a vision. And he had a vision in a time when Native American peoples east of the Mississippi River were under tremendous pressure, social, political, economic, cultural pressure. And he was not the only person having a vision. There were a number of Native American peoples east of the Mississippi that were having visions at that time, and those visions were very similar. And there are some authors, like Gregory Evans Dowd, who will be at the conference next week, they've called this the Indians' Great Awakening. It was almost like a revitalization movement in which Native American leaders began to stand up and say, if we don't, you know, think about what we're doing, we're going to lose, you know, our land, we're going to lose our culture, we're losing our lives. And so the visions, mostly along with the prophet's vision, the common themes they had were re-identifying their cultural traditions. Also, on all kinds of different levels, was to resist the influence of white culture. Sometimes the target was Christianity. Sometimes it was material culture and what they were using. Sometimes it was, you know, their leaders who were selling their lands, you know, for you know, money, and one big part of it was the alcohol trade. You know, the Anglo-European settlers, since the very first contact, traded alcohol, and it was extremely damaging to Indian people. And so, stopping the use of alcohol and stopping alcohol as a trade item, all those things were elements of these different kinds of moments of resistance. And so it was like after the Treaty of 1792, the Treaty of Greenville in Ohio, that's when there were so many white settlers coming into Ohio. The prophet had his vision in Ohio. That's when he decided he needed to leave. And there were other Indian leaders that thought it was best that if he took, he got followers right away, lots, thousands of followers. They were coming from the Great Plains, they were coming from New England, they were coming from all over to hear what he had to say. And so he thought it best if he removed himself and founded a community that was further away from all the white settlements that were all around them. And it was actually a Potawatomi visionary leader, Mainpak, who suggested that he come and settle his community here along the Wabash. And so he did. He left in November and arrived here in April of 2008. And there were thousands of people with him, and he got the settlement going. And then Tecumseh comes into the picture because they're both Shawnee and they're brothers. And Tecumseh, before even the prophet's vision, before he had this vision to found this community, Tecumseh was part of a several generations old heritage about resistance, right? Mm-hmm. He had witnessed his, you know, his grandfathers and his fathers who had tried to resist, you know, Anglo-European settlement. And he, as a young man, witnessed, you know, the loss of lands, the warfare, the death, the poverty. And so as a young man, he was very much for the idea of resisting. He saw the lands being lost. And so his ideas about a militant pan-Indian resistant preceded the prophet's vision, but it was kind of like fortuitous that these two brothers had a common goal, but different methods of reaching it. And so for Tenskwatawa, it was a religious revitalization movement. And then for Tecumseh, it was the idea that we need to make a military stand. We need to organize each other and put up a front that says no further. We're not selling any more lands. We're not signing any more treaties. You know, so they come together and the rest is history.
Which doesn't really explain the... Well, why don't you explain to me how maybe Tecumseh and his eloquence helped to build on the idea that the Indians were slowly, coming to the realization that while they thought of themselves as different nations, the Native or the North Americans and the Europeans that were coming into the area had the idea that these Indians were all one major group, and how that influenced the development of a pan-Indian culture.
Well, that's really a pretty interesting question, because part of the work that I do is on race and ethnicity and identity, and for Indigenous Americans, identity is a very convoluted process that's tied up in legal representations, you know, of being federally recognized or not. So it's a really complicated issue. But the idea,
especially since it's not really in their culture, so to speak.
Right. And the idea, what you mentioned, the idea of separate creations, that wasn't always the case. And you see that showing up very sporadically in Indigenous cultures, in their oral history and in their oral accounts and knowledge, Indigenous knowledge, that, you know, there was assumption among many groups that there was one creation of humans. Humanity was related, and humanity and everything else living on the planet was related, animals, you know, everything. But after contact, you start to see this kind of Indigenous perspective that recognizes there must have been different creators or different creations for Indian people versus white people, because they were so different and they were at conflict, and you know the Anglo-European approach to everything was so drastically different of a worldview, you know, and that their attitude was to, you know, is to destroy the Indian culture, then they couldn't have been, you know, didn't reconcile. But it wasn't for all groups. I mean, different groups had different perspectives, and also those perspectives about their origin and their spirituality also changed, like everybody's do. They change over time. So what was the other part of that question then?
Maybe how the realization that Indians and the Anglo-Americans were so different affected the development of this idea of a pan-Indian identity.
Well, I think ultimately it's, you know, to quote Vine Deloria, a well-known Native American intellectual, it was a trail of broken treaties. I mean, by the time you get here in the 1780s in Ohio and the Ohio River Valley in 1780s, post-American Revolution, I mean, Native American people have been dealing with broken treaty after broken treaty, and, you know, alliances broken and promises broken. So they're not new to this. I think the most profound impact was after the French and Indian War, you know, that they had been a part of a global conflict in a sense, and and that they had generally, most of the Native Americans in this region in the Ohio River Valley had sided with the French in that alliance. And they had sided with the French mostly in that alliance because the threat of the French was... This is not romanticizing French and Indian relations by any means, because they were also very genocidal. But the French interest was not so much in a land grab kind of approach to things. They were interested in trade, exchange, economics, intermarriage, everything. The English and the Americans / Americans wanted land, and they wanted Indians to be gone off the land. That was it. And so it was what I think after the French and Indian War, after 7 years war, when you begin to see the realization, you see divisions from village to village, family to family. You see there are some, you know, Native American families and leaders are saying, you know, we're going to accommodate, we're going to be pro-American, that way we're not going to get killed, we can stay here. You know, and they did these, they were motivated to do this to protect families, to protect their homes. Sometimes they were motivated out of greed, you know, just like any other group of human beings. But there were others, generations that just recognized that there was nothing that was going to help them maintain their lands. I mean, to them, being removed from their lands was a death sentence, you know. That's what their worldview, you know.
Their said. Culture was interconnected with the land
you
and the animals.
Yeah,
that
you cannot separate them.
And does that go back to the cultural creation stories?
It's still with those people today. I mean, Native American people see their identity is intimately linked to the places, you know, that they live, and they don't separate that out. And people who come from a Western European worldview also come from a Judeo-Christian worldview that says that the planet is this object that you conquer and subdue. Humans are separate from the rest of it. You know, that's their creation story. They're created separately and above all of it. Indigenous people know indigenous groups of people, you know, probably on the planet see themselves as separate. They are a part of it. So for them to be removed, their politics, their economy, their identity, you know, is disrupted. And the fact that you see Native American peoples who are removed and their cultures persist is a testimony to their ways of being able to reinvent their identity, you know, and how they do that in different places. So here it was a matter of timing. And the other key element a lot of people really overlook is that both of these men were Shawnee. The Shawnee, like the Delaware, are considered grandfather tribes. These are tribes whose history goes way back. I mean, they have deep time memories, you know, of origins, of coming out of the north, coming out of the cold. And the Shawnee especially were known for being travelers. Their people were located into the south, into Pennsylvania, into New Jersey, into Ohio. I mean, they were known for being a people that traveled very far in trade, in politics, you know, warfare, everything. So they were exposed, you know, in many ways, where you take another group who are very localized, like the Potawatomi, you know, whose existence was, you know, multiple state kind of area. The Shawnee had been around. They were witnesses for generations to the loss and dispossession and the changes in culture. So it's not surprising, you know, knowing about the Shawnee, that this leadership, especially Tecumseh's leadership, should come from this tribe and this nation. You know, a lot of people don't recognize that. They just assume Tecumseh, you know,
but
heroic warrior.
The Shawnee, and given their long-reaching ties, they made great ambassadors to
yes.
other tribes, and that's how their influence spread when they started there.
Right, and they had resisted at times before. They were a part of their culture was alliances with other groups historically, like the Delaware. They also had leaders who, you know, sold out and gave up and were willing to accommodate and allow the culture to come around them, so that they weren't without, you know, their problems. But it's very telling that this leadership for Pan-Indian resistance comes from the Shawnee. I think that's a really critical thing, you know, in this. So
with the French and Indian War, I really don't know. Did the Iroquois fight with the British? The reason that I ask this is simply because in my readings, I've come across the idea that the Iroquois sold a large part of the lands belonging to tribes in this area, claiming that they had conquered them.
Right, exactly.
In warfare. And then Tecumseh later comes in and says, I think partly based on the idea that even the chief for the tribe can't really speak for the tribe without the full support of the group, that he has proof that this land was not sold because the people that live on it don't recognize the authority of...
Exactly. Yeah, that's what some people say, too, that no tribe will get federal recognition in the state of Indiana, because the idea is that legally, if they did, Indiana's going to owe them a lot of money. Now, I don't know how true that is, but that's one of those things that runs around in Indian country. Partly what you're talking about is that, well, the Iroquois are five separate nations. Mm-hmm. They're called the Haudenosaunee, and there's five different nations in there. And during the American Revolution, they split. You know, some aligned themselves with French, some aligned themselves with Americans. Ultimately, most of them did not. And so General Washington at the time sent troops in, or not General Washington, but during the American Revolution he did that. But they were divided people. But even like from the 1680s until the period of the French and Indian War, the Iroquois had played a dominant role, you know, as a middleman in French, British, you know, and ultimately American negotiations. And they had very much claimed to be, you know, overseers of other Indian groups, whether they were or not. And Anglo-Americans or Europeans, Western Europeans, were always anxious for that one voice that they could deal with. That's the way their culture operated. Mm-hmm. So even from the earliest times, they had the greatest difficulties in political negotiations with Indians because they didn't understand there wasn't one.
There was no central head.
Right. They kept trying to call people king, you know, or queen. You see it all the time. And mostly the indigenous people, like in Pennsylvania and New York and into Ohio, like the Shawnee too, is they're organized by settlements, like small family groups or communities. And then the communities are like networks. So you can go and make a treaty with, you know, a settlement along this river, and there's a couple of leaders that come from those extended family, and they sign a treaty, but they're not speaking for all the Shawnee or all the Delaware. It just never existed. So the Iroquois play a role in that they serve that kind of image for, you know, Anglo-European concerns, that you can deal with us and you deal with everybody routine. But it wasn't actually true, right? So that was, I think, those voices that you hear from Tecumseh saying you cannot have one man sign for a nation, those voices had been expressed before. Mm-hmm. But he was, like I said, east of the Mississippi, he was one of those final, loudest, and most eloquent voices that goes down on the record for speaking that. And he speaks it right at the beginning of when the United States is its new nation. And right at the moment when the United States is facing English and French threat of being recaptured itself, right? I mean, that's basically it. It's a new nation. It's floundering. And so
there's an interesting mirroring there, too, between the threat facing the Indian nations and the threat facing the United States, mm-hmm. as to whether or not they can maintain their own identities.
Right. Well, I think that's why Tecumseh has become such a romanticized and mythologized figure in American military history and American political history, is because, you know, he's the noble savage, right? He's the noble savage that American identity would like to incorporate into itself, you know? Even though they want to destroy him at the same, it's like that, mm-hmm. American psychosis, you know, they will destroy it, but they also respect
you,
it.
You idealize certain qualities and then try to destroy it in order to absorb it,
yes,
back into
your... Yes, that's it, yeah. So yeah, it is. It's an interesting timing of events, but I think that, I mean, you even hear it, you see it in the language of even Harrison and his dealings with Tecumseh. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's respect and just hatred at the same time, that, you know, like, you're almost too good to deal with.
He charms them, and that scares them,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And his argument is sound. His argument is the argument they're making to France and the argument they're making to England, you know, and so how can they vilify somebody who's making the same debate? I mean, it's, you know, it's reminiscent of many times, you know, U.S. history when they go off claiming to be defenders of democracy, but they will... Mm-hmm. They will eat democracy alive in order to protect their own. So,
that was another question that I had. I had read that in Prophetstown, the prophet encouraged the people to kind of stay in one place, keep to themselves, farm the land. in a lot of ways, he was encouraging not drink alcohol. In a lot of ways, he was encouraging them to do exactly what Harrison and the people that wanted to integrate the Indians into the Anglo society expected them to do for their own good.
Right.
Why did they regard that as a threat?
Why did
the Anglo community regard...
Because they wanted the land. As long as they were on the land, then the land was unavailable. That's all. I mean, it's all. It's a very base bottom line, is that they were... Settlers wanted land. Settlers had expectations of all the land being theirs to possess, and at the bottom line, the Indians were inferior and they had no right to possess the land, so remove them. Just remove them. I mean, it becomes a federal policy by 1832 with Andrew Jackson.
Yes, I have.